Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode we're playing Spellbreaker by Jonathan Green, with illustrations by Alan Langford. This is book 53 in the long-running Fighting Fantasy series, and we've seen both of these creators on the podcast before, though not, I think, together. We cover Jonathan Green's excellent Alice in Wonderland-themed gamebook on a bonus episode, and his somewhat less excellent Doctor Who-themed gamebook on a different bonus episode, way back in the distant mists of the past. He's arguably one of the most important creators in the gamebook sphere at this point, and I believe is intimately involved with Fighting Fantasy Fest, the celebration of all things Fighting Fantasy. This is his first gamebook, I believe, and was written while he was still at university. I'm really looking forward to it. This is Alan Langford's sixth and final book in the series as an illustrator, and he also contributed cover art for the first time. The cover shows a big demon coming out of a tomb, while a skeleton-looking fella in a dark robe clutches a book in the background. It kind of looks like he's just waiting to get the demon's autograph, which is understandable because the demon is huge and impressive and covered with lightning. Honestly, the overall effect is kind of like it's just got out of the shower. Someone pointed out recently that I never mentioned the typography of the book titles, which do vary from book to book, which was an oversight. So I'm also going to note that Spellbreaker here is written in large, friendly letters that are a bit too close to Comic Sans for my liking. It's a fairly strong image. It's less painterly than most covers, which makes a nice change. It feels more like an internal illustration that's been amped up for the cover. And Comic Sans apart, I really like it. Before we get into the meat of this thing, I should mention that I'm now well underway with writing Mutiny, my new pirate-themed gamebook. I lost some time this week through mild illness, but I'm hoping to be able to pick up the pace in the next couple of weeks. I'm working hard to make it an all-ages appropriate book, dialing down my horror instincts and focusing on producing something streamlined and fast and easy to play. It's a slightly different challenge to previous books, but hopefully it'll keep my work feeling fresh. If you want a copy, then do consider signing up to my Patreon over at patreon.com/HJDoom. It's going to be going out to all patrons as soon as it's finished, hopefully before the end of the year. Let's take a look at the rules of Spellbreaker. We've got skill, stamina and luck all present and correct, and a single new stat, faith, which represents our goodness and that. It starts at 1, which is nice and easy to balance. It's always easier when you start with a fixed score. I think of all the additional stats we've seen over the years, things like this tend to fare best, so I am gently optimistic. There's no indication of how faith will work mechanically, which I also like because it adds an interesting level of mystery to the adventure. We've got the bare minimum of kit. 5 provisions, the obligatory sword and lantern, and that's it. It's all very nice and cleanly designed. Oh, you do get some gold. D6 plus 4 gold, to be precise. I have rolled up a character who I've decided to call Extrovert Tromboni, because that sounds like a suitably heroic name to me. They are absolute rubbish. A complete clown of an adventurer, with a skill of 7, a stamina of 17, and a luck of 8, plus that single point of faith that you start with, and a measly 5 gold. I very much doubt that they're going to make it, so in the extremely likely event that they die, the adventuring mantle will be taken up by their twin sibling, Introvert Tromboni, who is much bigger and buffer, with a skill of 11, a stamina of 22, and a luck of 11. I think that's quite a fun way of handling the inevitable demise that will result from me rolling up a character who's genuinely incompetent at everything necessary to be a successful adventurer. Possibly I'm going to be doing Extrovert Tromboni a disservice there, but we will find out as we play Spellbreaker. Background. With a deafening crash, another bolt of lightning shears through the boiling night sky. For a moment, the blasted heath round you is brilliantly illuminated, and through the driving rain you catch sight of shelter at last. But it is not the Abbey. Instead, a few trees stand huddled together on the barren moor, stark against the horizon. Through the sound of the storm behind you, you can make out the howling of wolves, broken occasionally by a banshee wail. With renewed determination, you find the strength to start running again over the sodden earth, with the blood pounding in your ears. Always love it when we start in media res. Lovely writing style, nice and clear, really drawing me in. I'm excited to find out what's going on in this situation, although slightly less excited because there's another 3 pages of background to get through first. As you near the copse, you pick out the glow from a small campfire among the trees. Someone has already taken shelter from the storm here. Cautiously, with one hand on the hilt of your sword, you step towards the fire. The figure seated beside the fire slowly looks up as you approach. "There's no need for that. I'm not armed," the man says, holding wide his arms so that you can see he is speaking the truth. Thunder rumbles across the moor, and the next flash of lightning reveals the man's face. He is young-looking, but his face is pale and drawn, as if it has seen a lifetime of hardship, while his eyes hold a deeper knowledge than his years suggest. And he is smiling. "Come. Take shelter by my fire," he says warmly. "It looks as if you need it." Tired and cold, you take up the stranger's offer. "Such a night as this, evil things stalk the earth, so people say." You look up anxiously as you hear a rustling in the branches of the trees. "What are you doing out on a night such as this?" he asks. You decide you have nothing to lose by telling this stranger your story, so you explain how you now find yourself lost on these bleak moors at night. All your adult life you have lived as a hired sword, searching for adventure wherever it may be found across the old world. However, for several years now you have considered taking a rest from the adventuring life in order to return to your homeland of Ruddlestone and undertake a pilgrimage for the good of your soul. So it was that 2 months ago you arrived at the north port of Harabnab. That is a stupid name. Harabnab. It sounds like a novelty biscuit. "Can I tempt you to a Harabnab?" "No, thank you. They look disgusting." So it was that 2 months ago you arrived at the northern port of Harabnab aboard a merchant ship from Arkleton in distant Annaland, just as the month of watching was coming to a close. From there, you began your journey on foot to the shrine town of Hallow's Well, at the edge of the western hills, renowned for its healing spring, as so many pilgrims have done before you. You were heading for Rassin Abbey, where you heard you could spend a night away from the wilds on the way to Hallow's Well, when the storm broke, causing you to stray from the road across the heath. You soon became lost on these desolate moors, certainly not the sort of place where you wanted to spend the night, what with the storm raging about you, wild animals roaming free, and possibly worse. I mean, it sounds as though I'm a terrible adventurer, which makes rolling up a bare minimum viable character all the more appropriate. I love it when you get that kind of synchronicity between the randomness of the dice and the character being portrayed in the text. The stranger tells you that he too is a pilgrim caught in a similar predicament, but he was fortunate to reach the copse before the storm grew too bad. However, he is sure he knows which direction Rassin Abbey lies in. The two of you decide to try and reach it together, which would be much safer than travelling separately. Leaving the cover of the trees, the two of you dash out through the pouring rain. Yes, having found shelter, the sensible thing to do is to immediately leave the shelter and return to the storm. Little bit of a Laurel and Hardy vibe creeping in from the outset. After running for half an hour with the wind and rain driving in your faces, you come to the top of a rise and see the road leading down to the small, dark stone building of Rassin Abbey, cowering under the terrible force of the storm. Then comes the scream. It chills you to the bone and curdles your blood. Although almost paralysed with fear, you and the stranger look around to see dozens of foul demons bearing down on you from the turbulent skies. They are grotesque to look at, with bulging eyes, bloated, misshapen bodies, writhing tentacles, vicious talons, and slathering jaws. They scream and gibber with excitement as they speed towards you over the heath. Turns out the abbey was located in Luton after all. Really nice description of the demons there. I really like a description of something demonic and unnatural that focuses on the details that give you the vibe of the thing rather than trying to describe the specific outline of the bodies. The next thing you know, you are hurtling down the hillside towards the abbey, your legs ready to give way under you at any moment. As you run, you fend off the demons by waving your sword wildly in the air. The stranger has no weapon, and so does the best he can with his bare hands. When you reach the abbey, you bang on the door with all your might, shouting for sanctuary. A bolt is drawn back and you fall into the space beyond. The stranger stands in the doorway, still trying to ward off the demons. "Quick, come inside!" you call to him. As soon as he's over the step, the door is slammed shut and bolted. One last chill gust of wind, all that remains of the gale outside. You pick yourself up and survey the huddle of anxious faces looking back at you. You are standing in a low-ceilinged hall, and the people surrounding you are monks, all dressed in plain brown habits. Once you have explained what the two of you are doing here, one of the monks tells you that they are a community of the priests of Enkala, and only a day's walk from Hallow's Well. He adds that you are both welcome to spend the rest of the night in their guest hall, and leads you to join the other pilgrims already sleeping there. Sort of seems as though the demons are a fairly routine occurrence if the abbot is not drawing attention to them. Further evidence that this is in fact Luton. You have not been asleep long when you wake from a terrible dream about demons to see the stranger creeping furtively out of the hall. Your suspicions aroused, you wait until he is gone, then follow him through the darkened passageways of the abbey. At last you come to a room which the stranger enters, closing the door behind him and locking it. Ooh, an exciting mystery. Suddenly, someone cries out from inside the room and there is a crash. You beat at the door with your fists, but to no avail, so you begin to try to break it down. You burst into the room at the same time as a group of monks enter through another door. You are standing in a library, and the body of a monk is lying face down on the floor beside his upset writing desk. There is no sign of the stranger. "Down there!" shouts a monk, pointing to a flight of stone steps beyond another open door. You run down the steps, followed by the monks, and burst into a small, dank room lit by a single torch. Against the far wall, the stranger is kneeling beside a large, open oak chest. And in the flickering torchlight you see that he is holding a huge black book in his hands. As you enter the chamber he spins around and gets to his feet. "Thanks, friend," he laughs mockingly. "Without your help I couldn't have got in here. I would stay longer, but I have much to do." With that a dark veil descends over the room. When it lifts again the stranger and the book are gone, but he has left something in his place. As you watch, a cloud of swirling, noxious green smoke starts to form in the centre of the room. Turn to paragraph 1. So, I would say it's a pretty good, if lengthy, opening section. Does a good job of telling us the stakes and giving us the vibe. Two things that I think are quite important. It hasn't explicitly said you've got to go and find this here book that this here stranger's half-inched, but that's clearly what we're going to have to do. Nicely written, really nicely written. Now there's a map on the facing page which is kind of nice and clear, showing that we're at Rassin Abbey, which is unusually at the top of the map rather than the bottom, giving an indication of where we might be able to go in the local area. So that's intriguing as well. Let us now turn our attention to this noxious cloud of gas. Quickly, the cloud solidifies into a shape that makes you recoil in terror. Standing before you is a monstrous demon covered in green scales, with fang-filled jaws and reeking of the sharp, acrid smell of brimstone. The foul demon begins to advance towards you, raking the air with its talons while sulphur steam rises from its mouth. Although it is a powerful beast, you are fighting the demon on holy ground, so blows from your earthly weapon will affect it. With a roar, the creature lunges at you. While you are fighting this hellspawn, you are affected by the sulphurous stench it emits from its mouth. So for the duration of this battle, you must reduce your attack strength by 1 point, which would normally be fine, but in this case it's going to be a problem because the brimstone demon has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 9, and I have a skill of 7, reduced to an effective skill of 6 by the unfortunate miasma that the demon has around it. There is a picture of the brimstone demon. It's really good. Classic, nice, clear Alan Langford illustration. Yeah, just really solid illustration. Although the demon is kind of giving me side eye, as if to say, this guy, which is fair enough, really. I'm going to fight the brimstone demon and quite possibly die in the first combat. So for the first time this adventure, I'm going to roll some dice. Pour one out for extrovert Tromboni, who died in battle without landing a single blow on the brimstone demon. Just the worst. Yeah, the most ill-fated adventurer so far. Possibly. I mean, I've definitely died in the first combat before, but have I died against such a low-skill opponent? I'm not sure. But yes, an ignominious death for extrovert Tromboni, but thankfully introvert Tromboni was on hand to take over, and introvert Tromboni made short work of the brimstone demon, successfully defeating it whilst taking only 2 points of damage. So introvert's stamina was reduced from 22 to 20, and as a reminder, introvert has a skill of 11 and a luck of 11, 10 gold and the standard 5 provisions. So we will continue. Yeah, sausagey finger bookmark rule, coming out early doors. Having banished the demon, you are taken by the monks to the infirmary, where Brother Hugo does his best to heal your wounds. Restore up to 6 stamina points. Stamina now 22. When you have had a little time to recover, the monks take you to see their abbot. In his private chambers, you meet Abbot Dunstan and the stern-faced Prior Alwyn. "We all thank you for destroying that abomination," says the abbot, "but I'm afraid it will prove to be just the beginning of our problems. A man who murdered Brother Hieronymus also stole a book, a very precious and very dangerous book." "Oh, well, the dead man has the same name as me." "It is the Black Grimoire, a book of dark magic," he says. "His pages contain the darkest and the most evil spells known to witchcraft. As the book is virtually indestructible, it was kept here at the abbey, on holy ground, so that it could never again be used to cause ill. And now it has been stolen. The thief knew exactly where to find the book, so he must have been here before," you point out. "Do you have any idea who he was?"
"We do," replies Prior Alwyn, "although it took us some time to remember. It is many years since we have seen him. His name is Nezek. He was a foundling of the abbey here long ago, and so remained under our guardianship. However, he was always causing trouble and was much more interested in studying the dark ways than the path of goodness. Despite our best efforts to correct his behaviour, by the age of 12, Nezek was experimenting with dark magic. It was not long after this that he disappeared on a night such as this. We were not sorry to see him go. Everyone assumed he had perished in the storm. But tonight he came back, thanks to you," Abbot Dunstan says, concerned. You look at him in puzzlement. "Evil such as Nezek cannot enter holy ground without an invitation, and you invited him. You remember the incident. The abbot is right. You must help us recover the book, and we know where you should look for the thief," says the abbot. "For in the grimoire there is one spell more powerful and life-threatening than all the rest. This spell is one of unlocking. What it unlocks is the Demifrag."
Demifrag? Demifrouge? I'm going to go Demifrag.
"You have heard of this?"
Seeing your recognition, the abbot continues.
"Yes, the legendary Casket of Shadows, the prison of the infernal beast. Last time this monster walked on Titan, hundreds died. Centuries ago, the casket was locked away in the monastery at Claybury, a village lying in the hills to the west. That was thought to be a safe place, but it may not be any more, as we thought the book was out of harm's way until tonight.
We believe, Prior Alwyn says, that Nazek must be intending to use the grimoire to open the Dimmerfraug. However, this ritual can only take place on the night of Shekhar's moon, in 4 nights' time. The grimoire must be going westwards to find the casket, so that is the way you must go too.
You will help us?
The abbot asks pleadingly.
Of course you will. You are responsible for the theft of the grimoire, so you must recover it. Besides, you have a score to settle with Nazek.
So, there we go. Mission finalised. A whole bunch of increasingly silly made-up names. Fine, par for the course. It's a bit mean to be complaining about lists of made-up names in adventure game books, but it is one of those things where I feel, overall, the lighter touch you can possibly use, the better. You manage to get a little more rest before dawn, but at daybreak you prepare to leave the abbey. The storm has passed, but the sky remains overcast and ominous. The abbot tells you that the library is open to your use and that you may visit the herb garden in case there are any plants growing there which you think may be of use.
However, he says, I cannot impress on you too greatly the need for haste in this matter. You have but 4 days to find Nazek and the book.
Bearing the abbot's words in mind, you decide what your first move will be. Do you want to study some of the books in the library, visit the herb garden, or leave the abbey straight away? Well, I love a library, so that's where I'm going to go. I worked in a library for a while, and it was a lovely job. You return to the library with Prior Alwyn, where you are introduced to a young monk, thin and scholarly in appearance.
This is Brother Calamus, Prior Alwyn says. He is one of our best illuminators and worked under Brother Hieronymus. He will help you with anything you need.
Brother Calamus ushers you to a reading alcove and brings you some volumes which may be of use to you. You do not have much time to spare in the library, so what will you study? Astrad's Holy Lives? An Astronomer's Almanac? No, an Astronomer's Almagest? Or a Demonological Dissertation? It feels like he's missed a trick by not calling the first one the Hagiography of the Hermits. Of the three, I feel as though some help with the demons would be most useful, so I'm going to read a Demonological Dissertation. A Demonological Dissertation was written by one Melkor Rankar, an eminent demonologist of recent years. In it are detailed many of the foul inhabitants of the pit and memorable servants of theirs on this plane. The book also describes several demonifugues, charms or amulets designed to drive demons away. Hidden among the pages you find mention of a demonic word of command. When this word is spoken in the presence of certain demons, they are compelled to do the speaker's bidding. That sounds very handy indeed. So, some useful background information there, but nothing directly useful. When you have finished reading, you see that Brother Calamus is anxious that you should not delay any longer in the library. Do you want to leave the abbey immediately, or will you visit the herb garden first? I will visit the herb garden first. You are led by Prior Alwyn through the abbey building and out to the monk's herb garden. Already busily tending the plants under his care is a thick-set, bearded monk.
This is Brother Trefor, says the prior. I'm sure he will help you select anything you consider necessary for your journey.
Brother Trefor is a jolly man and soon puts you at your ease. Between you both, you come up with 3 plants that it might be wise to take with you. Garlic, guaranteed protection against vampires. Aromance, a pungent, sweet-smelling herb used to guard against disease, and glebe balm, the leaves of the plant being used in many healing preparations. Unfortunately, Brother Trefor can spare only 1 of these plants, as the herb garden was badly damaged in the storm last night and many valuable plants were destroyed, making those that remain all the more precious. So, am I more afraid of vampires or disease? I'm more afraid of vampires because diseases, by and large, don't sneak up on you in the middle of the night. So I'm going to take some garlic. It's a bit irritating that the world is on the verge of ending and this guy's still going, well, I can only spare 1 herb. Okay, but how many herbs are you going to have if I fail in my mission
and the world ends. Is that going to also be zero herbs? Can't remember if I've said this before, but when I was a kid, I did used to put a tube of garlic puree on the windowsill when I was going to sleep because I was afraid of vampires, because I read a child's adaptation of Dracula at a very young age, and it had a big impression on me. I may have told you that before, in which case I apologise, but I've always been gently delighted by my younger self because, like, the tube of garlic does not smell of garlic until you open it. So I'm not entirely clear how I thought the tube of garlic would ward off the vampires. The abbot, Prior Alwyn, and a small group of brothers assemble in the yard of the abbey to bid you farewell.
May Chilar smile on your wanderings, says Abbot Dunstan, and remember, all our blessings go with you.
As he speaks these words, you are filled with feelings of hope and security. Add 2 points to your faith score. Faith now 3. The other pilgrims are already taking their leave of the brothers and are continuing the pilgrimage to Hallow's Well. With a fresh stock of provisions and your sword at your side, you prepare to do the same. Just as you are stepping through the gates of Rassin Abbey and leaving the hospitality of the priests of Enkala behind, a servant wearing the livery of some noble house rushes up to you.
"Excuse me," he pants, "but my mistress, Lady Atana of Ede, heard you were staying here and wondered if such a skilled swordsman as yourself would consider accompanying her to Hallow's Well. My lady is all too aware of the dangers of travelling, but with the wild beasts and bandits on the road, and she feels the need of extra protection after last night's terrible storm, which she feels was not of natural origin."
"Your reputation goes before you.
You have only been here a night, but already word of your presence has spread round the abbey visitors."
"My mistress is prepared to pay for your services,"
the servant adds with a look of hopeful expectation. "The money may certainly prove useful later, and there is something to be said about safety in numbers, but you do not want your progress to be slowed in any way. Do you want to accompany Lady Atana to Hallow's Well, or would you rather travel alone? I do like money, so I will accompany Lady Atana." 4 days, I feel that's plenty of time to get where we're going. I've already forgotten where we're going. This is one of the problems of reading stuff out loud and concentrating on getting the words right rather than really absorbing their meaning. I've already forgotten where we're supposed to be trying to get to. Claybury? Is it Claybury? I hope it's Claybury, because that's where I'm going to head for as soon as possible. After waiting for an hour, Lady Atana of Ede and her entourage finally emerge from the abbey's guest hall. Lady Atana herself is a middle-aged woman who has grown plump on years of fine living. She is dressed in clothes of the latest cut, and another sign of her wealth is a numerous ornate ring she wears on her plump fingers. Lady Atana and her party of ladies-in-waiting and bodyguards are all mounted on fine steeds. Her servants follow with her possessions on mules. Ah, the idle rich. Wonder if there's going to be any chance of holding her up and redistributing her wealth to the poor and needy. There is also a horse saddled and ready for you to ride. You mount and are soon on the road again, leaving Rassin Abbey behind you. The morning passes quickly as Lady Atana is talkative, to say the least. As your journey progresses, you discover that she has been a widow for 6 years. She decided to make the pilgrimage from her manor at Ede to see whether the healing waters on Hallow's Well could relieve the discomfort she suffers in her aching joints. Soon the road is joined by another from the south and enters an area of woodland. You pass other travellers heading in the same direction as your group, but soon lose sight of them again as you continue westwards. You become aware of a rustling sound in the trees to your left. Do you want to stop or keep riding, pretending not to have noticed?
I want to investigate the rustling.
It's got to be more interesting than this middle-aged woman's life story. It was wise to stop. There is a sharp twang and a crossbow bolt flies past you into a tree on the other side of the road. Your group is swiftly surrounded by men swathed in dark robes. One of them runs from the tree beside you with his short sword drawn. The brigand has a skill of 7 and a stamina of 7. I'm going to make short work of this ne'er-do-well. I can't help but feel I should be more on his side than Lady Atana's, but still, I agreed to the job, so I guess I'm going to have to murder this working class man. Then I'm going to do that by rolling some dice. I have defeated the unfortunate brigand. He managed to get one lucky hit in on me, reducing my stamina from 22 to 20. Having dispatched your opponent, you are confronted by a tall man on horseback wearing a long black cloak. You are startled to see that under his hood his face is covered by an iron mask. Maybe he's growing an ill-advised moustache for Movember and it makes him look like a second-hand car dealer. Either way, a gauntlet-clad hand pulls a fine sword from its scabbard. The sword glows with a faint blue light as it cuts through the air towards you. The masked brigand has a skill of 11 and a stamina of 12. So a much more difficult fight. But something interesting is going to happen after two attack rounds. I think this is great, by the way, luring you in with a nice easy fight against a brigand before suddenly hitting you with a much more difficult fight, albeit one that only lasts for two rounds, is a really, really nice bit of design. Playing with your expectations in quite a sophisticated way. Really like it. So, the Masked Brigand, skill 11, stamina 12. I'm going to roll some dice. I have fought the requisite two attack rounds, and I won both of them because I'm awesome. Let's see what happens now. Quite want his magic sword. The men who attacked you suddenly give up the fight and flee back into the trees, the masked stranger galloping after them. Do you want to give chase or let them go? I want to give chase. I want that glowy sword, thank you. Also, I want to find out what their backstory is. I'm very intrigued. You urge your horse forward into the dense woodland, eager to catch your quarry. Test your luck. I am lucky, just. Rolling an 11 against my luck of 11. My luck is now 10. Just in time, you hear the swish of a branch swinging back into position across your path. You duck, and the branch harmlessly flies over your head. You press on into the thicket, but soon you have lost all trace of the brigand's escape through the woods. Too late, you discover that you have ridden into a thorn bush. Your horse's flanks are bleeding from many small scratches, as are your own legs. Lose one stamina point and turn back to the road. Stamina now 19. I wonder if you can meet up with this fellow under slightly better circumstances if you don't travel with this middle-aged toff. Fortunately, no one in the party is badly hurt, the worst injuries being a knock on the head and a large sword gash among the bodyguards. Lady Atana cannot thank you enough.
We are all indebted to you for saving our lives. You were so brave and dealt with those robbers as they deserved. Sadly, they managed to get away with my jewellery box. They shouldn't be able to open it as it was carved from the wood of a magically protected forest of Lean. But it was given to me by my late husband on our wedding day. If you should ever by chance recover it, its contents are yours. It is the least I can give you for saving my life. But if you could return the box, I would be most grateful.
Lady Atana takes from round her neck a chain on which hangs a silver key. Of course it is. Lady Atana tells you that this was the year of her wedding. Well, that's a nice touch, trying to come up with a reason why a three-digit number is engraved on the key. I like that. You thank her, and when all is ready, you continue your journey. By late afternoon, the road is descending out of the wood towards the River Sanct. On the other side, the shrine town of Hallow's Well is clearly visible, a mixture of timber and stone houses competing for space within the confines of the old town wall. Your party crosses the wide stone bridge that spans the Sanct and enters the town by the eastern Pilgrim's Gate. The narrow street leads into the market square, which is packed with people. Lady Atana tells you she is heading for the Pilgrim's Rest, where she and her entourage are to stay the night. You are welcome to go with them if you desire. Or would you prefer to press on again by yourself? I think I've had enough of this lady. I'm going to press on by myself. Passing the reins of your mount to one of the servants, you bid the Lady Atana and her group farewell. She hands you a purse containing your fee of 10 gold pieces. You watch as her party is swallowed up in the crowded back street down which they ride. Gold now. 20. We're in the money. Oh yes, we are. The darkening sky tells you that night is coming on, so your thoughts turn to looking for a place to sleep. Following other visitors to the town along the narrow street leading to Hallow's Well, you are soon attracted by the enticing lights of the Ragged Clown.
It's a good name for an inn. Inside, a jovial mood holds sway over the bar as a group of dwarves are competing to see which of them can down the most crun cider, while the resident jester entertains the guests at their tables. You approach the landlord and purchase a hot meal and room for the night for 3 gold pieces. It's at the more expensive end of the tavern spectrum that we've encountered, but I guess it's pilgrim season and surge pricing is in effect. Get how topical I am with my surge pricing reference. You sit down at a table while a serving wench brings you your meal, and you are soon relaxed and laughing with the clientele of the inn. While you are watching the display put on by the dwarves, the jester, wearing his motley costume and ridiculous hat, skips up to your table and shakes his bauble, a stick with a carved head, in your face.
"For 1 gold piece, Coxcomb the Clown will grant your wish," the jester says in a squeaky voice, trying not to move his lips.
There is a picture of the tavern, and the jester kind of looks like the Green Goblin if the Green Goblin had had to dress himself out of charity shops. Yeah, it's a nice enough piece. Again, Alan Langford, such solid fundamentals. Tremendous sense of solidity to his figures. There's a really nice one in the background of a guy just standing and drinking a pint of crun cider, I assume. That's really just beautifully posed. Really great bit of naturalistic posing. It's really nice to see. Characters in these sorts of illustrations often can have a little bit of a kind of comic book pose to them, so it is always nice to see someone showing off draftsman's skills. But anyway, are we going to give Coxcomb the Clown a coin? I guess so. I mean, honestly, more from a sense of pity than anything else. You throw the clown a coin, and he deftly catches it in his hat, which he then puts back on his head, back to front. "Now then," Coxcomb says in his own voice, "what'll it be? A joke? A song? Or a trick? Which would you like?" I don't really want any of these. I kind of would like him to just leave me alone. But I guess I've paid my money, so what's going to be the least irritating? Magic tricks, a write out. A song could take forever, so I guess we'll go for a joke. If I get a custard pie to the kisser, there is going to be violence. Coxcomb pulls an exaggeratedly thoughtful face and then jumps onto the table, putting his hands on his knees. "What did the first tree say to the second tree?" He pauses for dramatic effect. The crowd now gathered round your table waits in tense anticipation. "Nothing! Trees can't talk!" There is a moment of silence. Then Coxcomb bursts into hysterical laughter, followed by the crowd, who are clearly very easily amused. This is sub-Chuckle Brothers stuff. He stops just as suddenly as he started, looks at you and adds, "Although I know a few druids who tell you otherwise. Remember, a fool can be a valuable friend." Coxcomb dances away from your table, followed by a band of admirers, leaving you to retire to your room. The night passes without incident, and you wake up fully refreshed. Restore up to 2 stamina points. Stamina now 21. You leave the inn and are immediately caught up in the early morning throng of people already making their way along the narrow street to Market Square. The Market Square is full of stalls with traders selling everything from needle and thread to a saddle and harness. It is likely that you will find something useful for sale here. Several alehouses are also situated at the edge of the square. The Healing Well is at the top of the hill to the north, and streets lead out of the square to the south and west. So we can look round the stalls, we can make our way to the Healing Well, we can visit one of the taverns, we can leave the Market Square by going west, or we can leave the Market Square by going south. Plenty of choice. Well, I'm interested to see the Healing Well. That is, after all, the big attraction that is bringing folk here. I kind of feel a bit wearied by the thought of going round the stalls. I feel as though that's going to lead to a big list of potentially useful items, and there'll be like 6 items that I want, and I'll be able to afford 4 of them, and I'll have to decide which of them's actually going to be useful, which is classic bit of adventuring business. But if I'm going to do that, I want to go and have a look at the well first. I don't need healing, but, you know, I think it's where I was headed before we started, so might as well take in the tourist attractions. As you climb up the hill, you pass others of all classes, some being carried in sedan chairs, others on crutches, all in search of a miracle cure for their aches and pains. At the top of the hill is the temple to the goddess. It is an unassuming stone building, and the approach to its pillared entrance is lined with beggars, some blind, some with missing limbs, others suffering from terrible wasting diseases. One old man whose skin is almost completely covered in ulcers and open sores calls out weakly to you, "Spare a dying man a piece of gold, stranger." Rather horrifyingly, if you had really bad ulcers in the ancient Greek world, one of the treatments available would be going to the temple, the Asclepion, something like that, and getting the sacred dogs to lick your sores. Just what you want if you've got an open wound on your body, a dog licking it. Anyway, assuming that that's not going to happen to this fella, I will chuck him a gold piece because he does seem genuinely on hard times. You toss a coin to the beggar and he manages a toothless smile.
Thanks, stranger. May Alyshanka look more kindly on you than she did on me.
The old man's words fill you with a sense of well-being. Regain one luck point and add one to your faith. That's nice, being charitable, serving me well. My luck is now 11, back to its maximum. My faith has grown to 4. You attach yourself to the line of pilgrims making their way into the temple and follow them inside. At the temple, you have the choice of taking the waters of the well or making an offering at the shrine of Enthus the Martyr, who awoke the healing springs here. I will make an offering on the grounds that I feel as though getting lots of faith is probably going to be a good thing, and I'm at full health. You kneel at the shrine of Enthus with the other pilgrims and pray for the departed martyr's soul and the successful completion of your quest. As you leave, you may place as many gold pieces as you wish in the coffer beside the shrine. I will leave 5 gold. That's all of my wages for the journey. Still leaving me with 10 if I need to buy anything. And I need to note down that I offered 5. Hopefully it's a d6 roll and not a 2d6 roll, if there is a roll associated with it. It's one of those things where the game designer in you is always there going, okay, how is this going to be relevant in a mechanical context? And there's kind of a number of different approaches you could take. One is you could simply ask later, how many gold pieces did you offer? And if it's above a certain threshold, a good thing happens. Or you could do it randomly by rolling like one dice and trying to get equal to or under the gold. Or you could roll 2 dice or 3 dice or however many dice you want. There's lots of different ways you could approach it. But on the basis that the amount of gold we've been given so far is not huge, I feel as though 5 is probably at the safe end. So anyway, that's me trying to game the system, even though I don't know what the system actually is. I'll try and remember to let you know at the end whether this gaming of the system worked or failed, assuming I don't actually make it in the recorded playthrough. So back at the market square. I guess we will look round the stalls. All of the stalls you would expect to find on a market are here, but your attention is drawn to one displaying the sign, Relics for Sale. Do you want to take a closer look at this stall? I would, yeah, sure. As you approach the stall, the vendor behind it rubs his hands together greedily, and under his hood you see pointed ears. A half-elf welcomes you and eagerly explains what relics he has for sale.
In this casket, he says, pointing to an ornate reliquary, rest the bones of a sage from the Cloud Cap Mountains. Many sought his advice, and his wisdom may be imparted to you through his remains.
The man holds up a tapestry embroidered with threads of all colours, including silver and gold.
It depicts a group of pilgrims undergoing many trials on their journey to a sacred shrine. This was made by a wife and daughter to celebrate their husband's perilous but ultimately successful pilgrimage to the shrine of Aquila at the edge of Lake Libra in Annaland.
He also points out a bottle containing the blood of a priest, the small, pocket-sized portrait of a bishop, a fragment of the shroud of Aline the Innocent, which looks suspiciously like an old piece of linen, and a yellow topaz pendant. After you have bought what you want, turn to the appropriate paragraph to find out what you now possess. So, sage's bones, out of my price range, sadly. I'd love to own, like, some martyr's bones. 20 gold pieces, that is.
Similarly, the Anilan tapestry is 15. The priest's blood, which is quite a cool relic, is 8. Bishop's portrait, which I'm definitely not going to take, is 6. The shroud, which is clearly a forgery, is 3. And the topaz pendant is 12. I can't afford most of those. I feel as though the only one with any actual resale value would be the topaz pendant. But I do want a relic, so I'm going to buy some priest's blood. Kind of hope there's nothing else I need to buy, because that's left me with 2. When you have finished this stall, you continue to make your way around the market. The next stall is owned by a falconer, who at present is involved in selling an eagle to a visiting noble. Do you want to purchase a hawk? I do not, because I can't imagine a hawk is 2 gold pieces. So we'll press on. A gaudily painted sign over the next stall reads, Hemlock and Hogweed, Apothecaries. The stall itself is crammed with bunches of herbs, jars and bottles, and a set of brass weighing scales. 2 men are standing behind their wares with sickly smiles on their faces. The first is a piggy-looking man with beady little eyes. His companion is tall and thin, with a deathly appearance.
Hogweed, my dear chap, I do believe we have a customer, says the tall man, who you assume is Hemlock.
Do you want to see what they have to offer? There's a picture of them, and they look like a proper nefarious pair of rogues, so I think I will give them a miss.
There is nothing else of interest to you in the market square, so you decide to leave.
You want to go west or south?
I need to head south. Time is of the essence. I guess we will go south. That was a pretty good market. A lot more interesting than the usual list of seal skins and ropes and that. So, full marks for creating something that does have the feeling of a medieval market whilst also having its own identity. Very much like that. We're heading south.
Leaving the bustling market, you walk past all kinds of shops and houses. Passing by an alleyway, you notice a figure, covered from head to foot in rags, lying face down in the shadows. It could either just be a drunk or someone in genuine distress who's possibly been robbed. Do you want to help the person, or will you hurry past?
Well, we need that faith, so let's do the Good Samaritan thing.
As you approach, the figure remains perfectly still. You turn the body over and are shocked to see that the man's face is covered in red, inflamed blotches, as are his hands. The man slowly opens his eyes and says,
Stranger, if you are going to rob me, I cannot stop you. But you will be forever cursed, for I have the plague.
Do you still want to help the man by giving him some provisions? Yeah, I think so. A packet of Monster Munch will set him right. Provisions now... 4. The man manages to eat a single portion of your provisions.
Thank you, my friend, he croaks. But in helping me, you have put yourself at great risk.
You assume the man has come to Hallow's Well to be cured of the plague. He confirms this and adds,
It took me 2 days to reach here because of my condition, but I fear it may already be too late. Others from my village set out as well, but could not get even this far.
You press the man for more information, and he explains that 5 days ago, a shadowy stranger arrived at the village of Ariel. However, the villagers were more concerned with what the stranger brought with him. Rats. Hundreds of the creatures swarmed into the village, invading cellars and sewers, and with them they brought the plague. Some of those infected set off for Hallow's Well, but this man is probably the sole survivor.
Leave me now, stranger, says the man. But if you can, save Ariel.
With these words, the man staggers to his feet and ever so slowly continues on his way. So, could that stranger have been Razak, taking time out from his busy schedule of trying to rob grimoires to just fill a village with rats? Either way, we will keep an eye out for Ariel. See if it's on the map, because there is a map. Okay, so, from Hallow's Well, we want to go east, or do we? No, I think north on this map is actually left. Do we actually want to go south? But yeah, anyway, I'm going to try and go to Ariel, see whether we can help out in some way. Leaving the man behind you, you follow the street as it enters a small square where all manner of entertainers, from jugglers to fire eaters, are putting on a show for the crowds. At one corner of the square, you notice that a rather drab-looking tent, patched in many places, has been erected. beside the tent, a faded painted sign informs you that the next puppet show will begin in just a few minutes. The entrance fee is 1 gold piece. Fine. I'll spend 50% of my remaining gold on a puppet show. There's no way this won't be a brilliant idea. As a horror film fan, I am, of course, naturally very suspicious of puppets. What puppets do is they come to life and try and murder you. Really frightening thing is that is the most entertaining thing that a puppet will ever do in its life. The tent is dark and smells of mildew. A boy stands just inside the entrance holding out a battered old hat into which you drop your gold piece. The other patrons of the puppet show are mainly mothers and nurses with their charges. Beyond a few rows of benches stands a wooden booth with a pair of moth-eaten curtains covering the opening. You sit down on the bench at the back of the tent. Almost immediately, the sign is brought inside and the boy picks up a small drum and beats out a tattoo. The curtains open and the show begins. Whereas everything else about the setup seems run down, the puppets are of exceptional quality. The story related is a typical tale of conflict between a young knight and an evil sorceress. Other characters in the story include a wise fool and a druid who gives the knight a golden sickle with which to cut the mistletoe to guard against the sorceress. In the end, the knight is, of course, victorious and goes on to lead a life of justice and honour. The show over, the members of the audience begin to make their way out of the tent. You are still amazed at the fine workmanship of the puppets and the skill of the puppeteer. Do you want to remain behind in order to speak to the puppeteer? Or would you prefer to leave the tent? I will remain behind to speak to the puppeteer. You ask the boy if you could have a word with the puppeteer. He leads you around behind the booth where a bespectacled old man is adjusting the costume on the wooden figure of the wise fool.
Grandfather, there's someone to see you, says the boy.
The old man looks up and nods a greeting. You tell him how much you enjoyed the performance and how you admire his puppets.
If you're interested, you could buy this one if you like.
If you are willing, you may buy the puppet of the wise fool for 10 gold pieces. I'd love to, but I only have 1 gold piece left. But the jester did tell us that the wise fool might be a worthwhile friend, so I'll remember that for subsequent playthroughs. Whatever you decide, the old man shows you how he operates his puppets, and when he has finished, you thank him for his demonstration and bid him farewell. Have you spoken to the man from Aril?
I have.
As you leave the entertainer's square, you pass a man sitting cross-legged on the ground beside the road. He's wearing a cloak. His face is hidden by the hood, and perched on one shoulder is a black rat. The man is playing the pipes, and some passers-by have thrown coins into the basket in front of him. As you walk past the piper, the tune he is playing suddenly changes and your head begins to spin. The music is having a hypnotic effect on you. Test your skill. I test my skill and I succeed. With my skill of 11, it was always likely. By pure strength of will, you break the mesmerizing power of the music. You approach the piper, but the man jumps to his feet and the rat leaps from his shoulder straight at you. Test your luck. I am lucky. Luck now reduced to 10. If you are lucky, the rat sinks its teeth harmlessly into your leather armour. You drag the piper's pet off you and crush it underfoot. The man hisses with anger, and dropping the charmed pipes, pulls out a dagger from a sheath on his belt. As he runs at you, you can see the fury in his eyes glaring at you from under his hood, and his rat-like features. You draw your sword to defend yourself. The piper has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 7. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the piper and I took no damage. Looking down at the piper's crumpled body, you notice his pipes lying next to him. Blowing into the pipes, they begin to play a tune all by themselves. You also see that the man is wearing an amulet around his neck in the shape of a crescent moon. Do you want to take the charmed pipes or the crescent moon amulet? I will have both, please. Probably one of them at least is a trap, but you know me, I can't resist stuffing things into my backpack. Hearing a shout coming from the direction of the south gate, you look up to see 3 of the town militia running towards you. If they catch you, you will doubtless be tried for murder, although you have saved the whole town from the plague.
Do you want to face the militiamen, or would you rather try and outrun them? Well, despite my general feelings about the police, these guys are just trying to do their job, and it would be a bit churlish of me to murder them. So I'm going to try and outrun them. Dashing down a side alley, you plan to lose the militiamen in the labyrinthine network of streets, then make your way back to the unguarded south gate. You soon emerge close to the town wall and run back towards the gate. Test your luck. Are you lucky? I am. Luck now 9. As you hoped, the gate has been left unguarded. Keeping close to the wall, you run out of town and away. So, I think that is a decent place to call a halt as we get out of Hallow's Well and embark on the next phase of our adventure. Yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. I do quite like just kind of, as I've said before, what feels like the low stakes end of the fighting fantasy adventure spectrum. I do quite enjoy just tooling around this pilgrim town, looking at all the shops and seeing their wares. It's not the most exciting, unfortunately, from the perspective of doing a podcast. This has very much been a podcast about an adventurer going on a city break to a spa town. But that's the way it works. Hopefully things will get a bit more exciting later on. We will find out, and I will be certain to report back when I have played through the rest of this story on my own time. I will be back for you in just a couple of seconds with some closing remarks. Tatty bye. Some things never change, and one of those things that doesn't change is my propensity for dying almost immediately after stopping the recording. On this occasion, I ended up being bitten by a werewolf approximately 4 paragraphs after leaving Hallow's Well. Lacking the means to cure myself, I became a werewolf and my adventure ended. I suppose, technically, I didn't die, which is something, but presumably, sooner or later, some hardy adventurer came along and put me out of other people's misery. It's a pretty classic fantasy ending, I can't complain. But I have now finished playing Spellbreaker, and my thoughts are conflicted. In some ways, it's an absolute delight, and in others, it's an absolute nightmare. It's a mixture of very assured design and schoolboy errors. On balance, and with some heavy qualifications, I actually had a good time with it. And because I want to leave you with the positives, I'm going to give an overview of the kind of book it is, then talk about the negatives, and finally move on to the positives, so we can close with some nice warm fuzzy feelings. Structurally, this is an adventure which will take you through a medieval landscape of villages and wilderness locations. You'll be rocking up to the various villages as you try and track down your nemesis, solving their supernatural problems, and then heading off to the next settlement before finally locating Razak and his gang of occult ne'er-do-wells for a final showdown. There's a unifying medieval aesthetic that ties everything together, and the landscape and settlements feel quite plausible, and I would say more realistic than many game books. This being a game book, you'll have a shopping list of items to find, and this is a pretty chunky weekend shop, not just popping down to Lidl for a few essentials on your way home from work. You'll also be trying to boost your faith every chance you get, because the bonus stat in this adventure is actually extremely important. There's a fair number of fights, but also lots of bespoke encounters along the way, and although everything has a similar vibe, there's very little actual repetition, and that is nice to see. If we're talking about problems, the biggest problem is this book being unfathomably broken, if you attempt to play it as it is written. If you try and play this book following the rules as written, I'd place your overall chances of success at probably worse than 500 to 1. I haven't fully crunched the numbers because life is too short, but I have done a few back of the fag packet calculations, which are enough to tell me that Spellbreaker is completely banjaxed from a rules perspective. The book is already hard as nails before we get into the broken stuff. There's basically one true path, because of the aforementioned laundry list of items that are needed to win. Miss an item, and it's game over. There's almost nowhere where missing a key item is just going to make life a bit more difficult. Some of those items are tricky to get hold of. A good example is the swamp maze. Now, I'm not a fan of mazes at the best of times,
But actually, this one could have been quite neat. It's got multiple paths through it. It feels a lot more pleasant to explore than a series of identical stone corridors. There's some great encounters to be found within it, and it's quite short. Unfortunately, there's also not one, but two required items hidden inside it, meaning that despite the maze being fairly welcoming on the surface, in practice, you're still going to have to go through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure you've picked up all the bits you need. If this was the worst offender in terms of difficulty, that would be fine. It's not the way I'd do it, and I think secreting two items in the swamp is sadistic at best, but it wouldn't be a deal-breaker. Similarly, there's a fair number of tough fights, enough to make a low-skill character completely unviable. There is a couple of places where you can pick up some extra skill along the way, but you're still going to want to be at the upper end of the skill spectrum to be sure of getting through them. And this certainly wouldn't be a deal-breaker. It'd be fine, except for one massive thing. There's a fight which needs to go on for 10 rounds so that you can get captured by the watch, so that you can get locked up, so that you can get an item from someone in the jail. The problem is, if your skill is high enough to get through the rest of the adventure, there's every chance that you'll beat the two guards in 9 rounds or less. If your skill is low enough that the fight will go on for 10 rounds, then something else in the adventure is definitely going to murder you. Also, and I've said this before, gating progress behind what feels like failure is perverse and you probably shouldn't do it. Succeeding because you've failed to win a fight feels intuitively wrong. You should feel pleased when you succeed at something, not disappointed. You'll often run into situations in a game book where progress is locked because you don't have an item or a piece of information. In the best game books, this makes you think about where you might go on your next playthrough to find those items. Perhaps the jewel I need might be in the dragon's lair. Maybe the apothecary sells the herb that will help me defeat this interior designer. When thinking about succeeding in a task, it's a standard part of human psychology to create narratives that might explain how we would go about succeeding in that task. If we need to open a door, we might imagine ourselves forcing it open, picking the lock, or finding the key. We don't generally imagine falling over and breaking our leg, or being savaged by some geese, because that just doesn't feel like it'll be a useful step in the process. So if you write a game book where you need to fail in order to succeed, unless the narrative clearly flags that as a possibility, you're working against the very way that the human brain naturally operates. It's not a question of cleverness either. There's a bunch of broadly useful cognitive biases at work, some of which may be a direct consequence of how the human imagination works in a functional sense. You can train yourself to check the consequences of failure, just as you can train yourself to understand how cryptic crossword clues work, but it's never going to feel natural or satisfying in the same way as realising that two orcs have got the same family name or whatever. It can feel clever from the design side, but it isn't. It's just making finding the right path much more mentally taxing, because now you can't just explore. You have to check the consequences of every single roll in case falling off a log is secretly the most important thing you'll ever do. Don't make people fall off logs to succeed unless they've ended up on that log through their own hubris. This kind of design also shapes behaviour in unhelpful ways. It's as if in every hurdles race there was one hurdle you had to kick over instead of jump over, but no one was told which hurdle it was before the race. Inevitably, what the runners would end up doing is kicking over every hurdle so that they definitely kick over the one they were supposed to kick over and don't get disqualified. And that's not really the behaviour you want from runners in a hurdles race. You want them to be jumping over hurdles. For a real-world example of this sort of thing, take a look at the history of the rules of billiards, which have had to become steadily more baroque and counterintuitive to try and compensate for various effective but incredibly dull strategies. There is a secret kicker in this guard fight, however. In one of the many proofreading problems that mar later books in the series, apparently there's actually a missing option. According to the Fighting Fantasy Wiki, there should have been an option to surrender to the guards. And if that had been included, this entire encounter would have been absolutely fine. It then would have been clever. Because surrendering to the guards is something that a player would probably try sooner or later. And if you had that option, putting a little escape hatch in the fight with the guards so that even if they make the wrong decision, there's a chance it might work out okay, that would have been a really neat trick. Now, I should say, you can, in theory, string the fight out by repeatedly testing your luck early in the adventure so that you reduce it as far as possible. Then, when you get into the fight with the guards, you repeatedly test your luck and fail so that you only deal one damage to them every time you win an attack round. This does technically work, but it's so insane I cannot believe it's the intended strategy. The rule stuff does get more insane, though. There's an item called a cure-all which you need to complete an area, and it's locked behind a 1-in-3 faith roll, which is made in the healing shrine in Gallows Well. So you go and get some of the miracle water from the Gallows Well, and if your faith is high enough, you have a 1-in-3 chance of getting the cure-all as a reward. In order to have that 1-in-3 chance for the cure-all, you need to have passed a previous 50-50 faith roll, which will reward you with the 2 additional points of faith you need in order to get the Gallows Well shrine roll up to a 1-in-3. That means that right from the off, only 1-in-6 adventurers will actually have one of the required items you need to finish the book. There's also an obligatory 50-50 random roll to survive a witch trial later in the adventure where failure leads to instant death. So you're now down to a chance of winning, which is 1-in-12, even if you do absolutely everything else right and make it through all the fights, skill tests and luck tests that are littered throughout the book. I know designing game books is complicated and you can't check everything, but this is basic stuff. Don't write your game book so that the upper limit of success is 1-in-12. There is technically a way to attempt the faith roll to get the cure roll repeatedly by going between the healing shrine and one of the taverns. Because each journey to the shrine will cost you 3 gold, 2 to obtain the holy waters and 1 to avoid being cursed by a beggar, you'll want to play the gambling minigame with the dwarf in the tavern. If you go to one of the taverns, there's a dwarf who'll play a game with you, and it's essentially a game of snakes and ladders played on a circular board where you move around d6 squares collecting tokens until every token has been collected. It takes forever, and you've got a 50% chance of winning, meaning that unless you have better than average luck, you won't actually make any money from it. Technically, you can do this minigame as many times as you like, and then go to the shrine as many times as you like, and you'll gain 1 faith on each journey by giving the beggar more and more money. So as long as you have the patience of Job and the dice are on your side, you can emerge from this sequence with sky-high faith and multiple cure-alls. And that means that you can afford to burn luck on the guard fight because you can replace it with your spare cure-alls so long as you keep 1, which you'll need later. I've seen it suggested that this time-consuming and fantastically boring approach is the intended way to beat the book. I dispute that. It's certainly not written like any of the encounters are intended to be replayable. There's no mention of you having potentially been there before. The beggar will not recognise you if you meet him multiple times. If this is the intended strategy, it suggests that young Jonathan Green had the kind of reservoirs of misanthropy you normally only see in Tasmanian devils or people who work in French restaurants. I would much rather believe that Jonathan Green simply made some mistakes in the design process rather than believing he wanted you to go through this absurd and repetitive rigmarole. Obviously, I'm not throwing shade at the people who came up with those strategies. I'm enormously impressed. They're extremely clever ways to tackle a book of astonishing difficulty on its own terms and come out ahead. I'm really impressed with the mindset that's able to look at this thing and go, no, wait, there is a way that we can reliably spin this fight out for the requisite number of rounds to make sure we've got a decent chance of getting the required item from the jail. Genius strategies. Not fun. Not fun at all. Assuming you don't fancy trying your luck with the dwarves,
mind-numbingly stupid gambling game that takes 3 hours and could have been a coin toss, you'd better hope you rolled literal maximum for gold at the start, because that's the only way that you're going to afford all of the stuff you literally need to win the game. Otherwise, it's bad news. You're definitely playing the dwarf and his stupid game to try and win the coins you need. There is a bear baiting mini game, but I honestly couldn't bring myself to do the bear baiting section more than once. Assuming you didn't roll maximum gold and you are forced to play the dwarf's game and you're only going to play it once because that feels like how the book's been written, that's another 50-50 roll you can tack on. So if you haven't made your 1 in 6 roll to get maximum gold, you can double that 1 in 12 chance we talked about earlier to a 1 in 24 chance, which is about 4%. Even if you did roll maximum on the gold, you should probably try and play the dwarf's game, since the maximum starting gold leaves zero wiggle room, and there's no indication of which items are going to be required. You are going to want as much cash as possible to buy as much of the stuff on offer as possible. If I've gone hard on these facets of the book, it's not because I want to say Jonathan Green is a bad creator. It's simply because I've spent a lot of time checking stuff and going over things. I am indebted to Champskies over on the Fighting Fantazine forums, who has posted a complete solution to the gamebook and several clarifying comments. I should also mention that the various workarounds listed earlier were from commenters on the Malthus Dyer article on Spellbreaker. And it's always good to be reminded that there's people out there much better at analysing systems than I am. I certainly wouldn't have been able to get to this point of understanding how the opening of this book works without their support. But controversially, aside from the borderline unforgivable lapse where you need to not win the fight with the guards, I don't think most of the issues that I've laid out make the book unplayable. It makes it more or less unplayable as written, unless you especially enjoy finding and exploiting loopholes in the rules. But if you're prepared to take a more relaxed approach, shall we say, to the tyranny of the dice, there's actually an awful lot to like in here as well. I think the reality for most children reading fighting fantasy books was that they were concerned more with the story than the mechanics, and I know a lot of readers didn't bother to roll dice at all or just assumed their character had maximum stats. And if you approach Spellbreaker like that, it's honestly great. Green is a fundamentally solid writer. His paragraph descriptions are evocative and well-paced, and they do a great job of creating a world that feels very coherent and which has underlying themes that tie together in a very pleasing way. As a space to explore, the lands between Rassin Abbey and Claybury are enormously fun. You've got this series of villages, each with something weird going on in them, along with several wilderness locations which add variety. Despite the ambient level of supernatural threat being very high, it really does feel like travelling through a plausible landscape. It somehow feels a lot more authentic than many fighting fantasy locales, because there's such a consistent tone and the social backdrop across all the different locations remains the same. It's up there with City of Thieves for creating an environment that feels consistent and lived in. And I really like the experience of travelling between the various villages. It feels like travelling through the English countryside in a sense. There's less of a sense of a vast wilderness and more a sense of the ordinary world being turned upside down. It's one of the strongest features of the book that it feels so well localised within a recognisable landscape. Often fantasy stories focus on the wild and the exotic, so it feels like a breath of fresh air to come to something that feels strangely familiar. Now, we've seen a lot of markets in fighting fantasy books, but the one at Gallows Well might just be the best of the lot. The stalls Green chooses to focus on feel fresh and different, but also thoroughly, plausibly medieval. Who doesn't love the chance to buy a hawk and the chance to buy some saint's bones? That's just great. and it feels a lot more medieval than many fighting fantasy books do. The concerns of actual medieval people feel a lot closer to the surface. You can see a lot of Chaucer in the book, especially in the opening sections, which owe more than a little to the general prologue to the Canterbury Tales, right down to being able to engage in a little competitive tale-telling with other pilgrims in Gallows Well. Religion and superstition feel much more central to the lives of the people. In this secular and scientific age, it's hard to grasp the extent to which religion and the supernatural permeated society in the medieval period. You could draw parallels perhaps with the way TV or the internet permeate our own age, and Spellbreaker does a great job of showing you a society where religious practices are widespread and utterly central to the experience of life, and that is a hard thing to do in a game book. Although some of the mechanics are problematic, I think the use of faith as an additional stat is generally pretty strong. Sure, the actual dice rolls you need to make with faith, particularly early doors, are pretty poorly judged, but the places it crops up and the purpose it serves within the story feel really good. It's an impactful mechanic. It's completely necessary to beat the game, and the way in which it's been presented is often really cool. You can obtain faith by doing good deeds, which is how modern people tend to understand faith. But there's also a focus on relics, something that was hugely important to medieval religion, and a couple of visions along the way, which are enormously important elements of the medieval religious experience. The actual form of the religion, its contents, are depicted in a way that's vague, deliberately, I think, in order to focus more on the cultural practices that arise from the religion than its theology. Now, I'm a theology nerd, so I'd have loved to have seen a scheme of salvation worked out in the text, but as a practical choice, this makes sense. It's less alienating, and it provides the ambience of a society permeated by religion without needing to get hung up on details that could be challenging or controversial, or just very dull if you're less of a theology nerd than I am. It's a smart decision. Aside from anything else, game books are driven by actions and by items, and it makes sense to focus on the elements of faith which can be represented through those modes of expression. Now, superstition is the ugly step-sibling of faith, and Spellbreaker gives us a great depiction of a society that's riddled with superstition, with a twist that most of the superstitions are actually bang on the money. There's a lot of panic about witchcraft in medieval and early modern society, and if you're interested, it's well worth reading the Malleus Maleficarum of Heinrich Kramer if you want an insight into how cultural anxieties, specifically male cultural anxieties of the 15th century, were projected onto supernatural agencies. Very much the QAnon of its day and a fascinating document. There's a lot of witches and warlocks and creatures of the night in Spellbreaker, and everyone is very afraid of them. There's some lovely medieval details like a warlock flying on a pitchfork and a witch's familiar demon being called Grimalkin, which was a very popular name for a witch's familiar in the early modern period. You get a bit of weather magic from three classic witches on broomsticks. Love that. And I'm a big fan of game books where an author really strip mines a particular vein of inspiration, and that's something Green has done particularly well with this book. There's a reason why Robot Commando was kind of my favourite science fiction fighting fantasy book. It's because it's a book that says it's about giant robots fighting dinosaurs that focuses a lot of its attention on giant robots fighting dinosaurs. Witches are a constant presence in the book, and you can get fingered as a witch yourself in the later portions, which really highlights the corrosive effects of paranoia, even if that paranoia is in this world frequently justified. It also highlights the reality that the powers of darkness are just as likely to be at work in the authorities looking for witches as anyone who has seen the classic movie Witchfinder General can attest. There's a lot of witch moments, but I think my favourite is the bit where you can get into a fist fight with a version of Baba Yaga's hut, a cottage hopping along on a single chicken leg. I'm not aware of any other game books that let you fight a house. Let me fight more buildings, you cowards. It's not just witches, though. There's also plenty of demons and other monsters to be found in the story, and you do get an opportunity to have another crack at the mysterious brigand with the mask we saw in the recorded playthrough. and it all comes together at the end with a very nicely designed finale, which is a full-on black mass complete with summoned demons of all different kinds. It's pretty tough, but if you've made it that far, you're almost certainly cheating already, so it doesn't feel especially egregious in the context of the book as a whole. Overall, it's got some tremendous set pieces, so many that it's hard to pick a favourite, but I think I'll single out the village of Ariel for special mention. Plague is another reality of medieval life, and Ariel is an amped-up version of a plague village, complete with an infection mechanic that's simple but works really well to capture a sense of rising panic. Doing the infection stuff in a smaller space, rather than doing it as a feature of the book as a whole, makes it feel much denser, and it allows that sense of panic to hit all the more quickly. It's not an especially long or deep design, but the overwhelming presence of rotten decay and disease and the various undead monsters within the barrow you need to explore give it a very strong aesthetic, which stands out from the rest of the book, whilst also fitting in with the rest of the book. And it's lifted by Green's prose again. Yeah, it's just a great moment, standout moment, a good idea, handled appropriately, and given exactly the right amount of mechanical juice to elevate it. One mechanic I'm glad doesn't feature is time. There's something delightful about being told you only have 4 days to save the world, and then just continuing with your planned holiday, seeing the local tourist attractions, and taking in a show. It's not often I get to see my own approach to procrastination represented in game books. If the book had told me I needed to edit a podcast in 4 days, this is exactly how I would behave. I'm very much a last-minute kind of guy. There is a slight issue with pacing as a result of announcing a time pressure and then not really doing anything with it, but it's one I'm more than happy to forgive. You can take a fairly leisurely approach despite the alleged threat of looming doom, and honestly, I prefer this to other ways you might implement time. It crops up in the text from time to time that time is wasting and you should get on with stuff, and that's fine. I'm not a big fan of time pressure in general. I don't think it's a bad thing in and of itself, but it pings my anxiety when you tell me I've got a clock counting down to something. Probably more than it's intended to. I've been playing Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask recently, and that does some amazing things with time, but it also stresses me out something fierce, even though I can always reset the clock in that game. It's definitely a me problem rather than a problem with the mechanic itself, but I'm still pleased that here time is dealt with in a more abstract way. You've got 4 days and you'll always somehow arrive with moments to spare, regardless of the path you take, and that's fine. I prefer the illusion of time pressure to complicated systems that try and turn it into a mechanic, because they rarely work, although occasionally something like Siege of Sardath does do a decent job. Overall, and absurd difficulty aside, I think this is a very strong opening book from Jonathan Green. Once I decided that I was going to more or less ignore the dice, I started having a really good time with it. And there's a lesson there in that sometimes you just need to come at things in your own way to get the best out of them. Like the way I used to play Grand Theft Auto 3 for hours just doing the taxi missions and kind of ignoring the story. It was pointed out to me recently that the people writing for Fighting Fantasy were creating in much more of a vacuum. It's easy to forget that the world hasn't always been as connected as it is now, and there just wasn't the same volume of feedback on literally everything anyone creative put out into the world when people like Jonathan Green were writing for Fighting Fantasy. Game book designers were much, much more on their own, and I should probably try and remember that and maybe cut them a bit more slack. That is all for this episode. Next time we'll be doing a bonus episode, probably A Way of the Tiger book, as we haven't had one for a little while, and I want to see how the next bit of that series unfolds. You can contact me in the meantime by email at hjdoomretrofun, all one word, @gmail.com. You can follow me on Blue Sky at HJ Doom, and the show is now on YouTube. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.